Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins, and he's here to talk about the election that's going to take place in November. So, Howie, how has your little adventure been? Is it fun?
Yeah, I would say I'm enjoying it. Wasn't what I'd planned to do in my retirement, but a lot of Greens asked me to run. And, every day we're able to speak out on the issues before us. And so hopefully it's going to be a positive impact.
Now, how has the fact that the coronavirus has changed everything, how has it affected your campaign?
Well, I've been online, doing Zoom meetings, Skype meetings, BlueJeans meetings, StreamYard meetings, meeting with actually probably more people than I was meeting when I was spending half a day driving across the state or half a day flying across the country to meet with people face-to-face. So I'm able to stay here at home and actually meet more people in those kinds of meetings. So it's, Green Party meetings in the 50 states in D.C. It's people that are interested in the campaign, a lot of them refugees from the Bernie Sanders campaign. So, it's working pretty well for us in these circumstances. You know, I prefer to be there in person, and it's just a different feel, but we're probably meeting more people this way right now.
So let's talk a little bit about the presidential race. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. From the people who supported Bernie, how are they feeling right now?
There's a lot of disappointment. They're disappointed that Bernie didn't get the nomination. I think they're disappointed that Bernie is backing Biden and compromising. I mean, he told Ali Velshi on MSNBC a few weeks ago that he would accept a compromise on Medicare for all, so it would only include people over 55 and children, and in between they'd have the public option, which, Bernie was criticizing. The public option costs more, but he seems to be willing to bend to Biden's priorities, and so a lot of his supporters are disappointed, and they're coming to us.
Why do you think Bernie Sanders capitulated to the establishment so quickly?
Well, he's got 4 more years on his Senate term, and I think he's just calculating that if he's a team player for this election, he'll have influence in his last 4 years of his current term. That's the best guess I have. I mean, he wants Trump out of there by any means necessary. That's understandable, but you get rid of Trump and you go back to the status quo and things don't change, and these are life or death issues. The climate meltdown, the inequality crisis, which has led to declining life expectancies for working class people in this country, and the new nuclear arms race, which nobody's talking about except our campaign.
You know, when I watch the news and I look at the paper, and I see the two front runners in the major parties, it's sickening. It's absolutely sickening, because I don't think either one of them belong where they are. Neither one of them are really going to govern the United States in a time of crisis that it should be governed. As you talk to people, what's your feeling about Trump? What's your feeling about Biden?
Well, I think the coronavirus health crisis has exposed for everybody to see that the two governing parties in this country are presiding over a failed state. We can't figure out how to test, trace, and isolate the infected, which most countries in the world have done. In the Pacific Rim, from New Zealand to South Korea, they've done that and suppressed the virus. In this country, it's every state for themselves, and there's no national coordination, not just to get the testing, tracing, and isolation going so we can go back to work safely, but they're still having trouble getting personal protective equipment, to where it's needed, medical supplies to where it's needed. It's a complete disaster. Trump is obviously incompetent, and really he comes across as indifferent to, you know, the people's problems. And Biden is largely invisible, and when he does pop his head up, he's incoherent. When you think of Biden, what's his message? You know, it's not clear. So I think this is an opportunity for the Greens in this election to step into that political vacuum and point us in a positive direction, not just on the coronavirus crisis. But another thing that's been exposed for everybody to see is this centuries-old pandemic of racism. And again, you know, Trump wants to suppress peaceful demonstrations with the military, and Biden can only talk about reforming racists, and it's going to take a generation. And, you know, these young people aren't going to wait a generation. They're talking about ending the self-policing of the police, which obviously hasn't worked, and having community control of the police so we can get the racists out of the forces. And that goes across the board for systemic racism. You can't wait for the racists who are the gatekeepers, you know, whether they're the real estate industry that segregates us, employers who discriminate, lawyers and judges who preside over a biased criminal justice system. You know, we want to get rid of those people instead of waiting for them to reform themselves. And I think, you know, that's the direction that, you know, the Green Party now can point people in and get a lot of support and have leverage as we go forward after the November election.
Now, I know that Jill Stein had gotten, you know, not a lot of coverage, but her name was out there. I don't see too much coverage for you. Do you think that's going to change as the campaign evolves?
Yeah, I think it will. I'm leading in the Green Party primaries, and we have our convention July 11th. So when I am the nominee, they'll pay more attention to us. And they already are. I mean, I've been attacked in the New York Post, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, the L.A. Progressive for potentially, quote-unquote, spoiling the election for Biden. And, of course, my answer to that is no. Biden and the Democrats are spoiling the election, because since Nader ran in 2000, we've been giving them the proven nonpartisan solution to the spoiler problem, and that is to replace the Electoral College with a ranked choice national popular vote for president. And I don't even think Biden knows what that is. I'm sure Trump doesn't. And that's why, you know, the Green Party has to be in this race to put that solution forward.
So let's talk about Biden a little bit. I think that nominating Biden as the nominee was a tremendous mistake. What's your thoughts?
Well, from the viewpoint of the Democratic establishment, he's what they wanted. From the viewpoint of the people and getting solutions to the problems we face, like the health care crisis, Medicare for All, it's a disaster. So while Trump is terrible, Biden has no solutions. And so, you know, I think the Democrats have set themselves up potentially for what happened in 2016 when they ran a candidate who was not popular, Hillary Clinton, particularly with working class people. Most of them didn't flip to Trump. Most of them didn't flip to Trump. They stayed home. Biden faces that danger, although I think given what's happened over the last 12 days with people out in the streets demanding racial justice, those people I think are going to come out to vote, and they're going to vote against Trump. And I think Trump is toast. He blew the coronavirus crisis. He has no solution to the coronavirus depression. You know, all he's interested in is making sure the wealthy come through this. He doesn't care about the regular working people. And, you know, even the generals now are saying he's a threat to the democracy. So, and his poll numbers show that. He's in trouble. So if Biden can't beat that, he and the Democrats can't do anything.
What do you think the establishment wants Biden over anybody else?
Well, they want to keep making money. They are not concerned about the growing inequality and the fact that it's led to declining life expectancies for working class people. They're more worried about the next quarter than the climate meltdown. To them, the arms race is a profit opportunity, not a threat to our existence. I mean, that's what they're looking at. They're looking out for their own interests. And they are so isolated and segregated from the rest of the population now. They don't even know what most people are going through. So in a way, they're out of touch. And I think that's why they're kind of baffled by people who are out on the streets now, because, you know, it was the police murder of George Floyd that triggered this. But underneath that is a lot of anger about a whole lot of things, including, you know, most of the people out there on the streets are young people, and their economic prospects are dismal. And so they have a lot of motivation to get out and try to make changes. And so I think the establishment in the Democratic Party is out of touch. They're as out of touch as the Trump people, just have a little different perspective on how to keep the rest of us contained and powerless.
Do you think that the establishment of the Democratic Party realizes how bad things are for the average American?
No, that's what I'm saying. They're clueless. They have no idea. They live in their gated communities and, you know, their elite circles. They really have no idea. There was, you know, that metaphorical critique of George H.W. Bush when he went to a grocery store and saw the scanners and, you
right.
know, commented that, wow, this is something new. Of course, everybody else, you know, went and got groceries, knew that he was out of touch because he never had to buy his own groceries. And, you know, I think that speaks to where the political leaders in both parties are. They're out of touch. They don't know what we're going through.
The average person who lives day to day, why are they gravitating to the two major parties if the two major parties don't represent them?
Well, they don't know about, you know, the option like the Green Party in some cases. In other cases, they think, yeah, that sounds good, but it can't win. So I'm going to vote defensively, in this case, against Trump. So I think that's why, you know, a lot of people do that. But the more votes we get, the more we change the psychology. And I think the way we're going to build the Green Party into a major party is to begin electing thousands of people to local offices, including the local districts of state legislatures and Congress, as we go into the 2020s. And then people will see that the Greens are not just a group with good ideas, but a group that can win elections and make a difference.
How has that been working out? Has there been a lot of candidates on the state level that are tossing their hat in the ring?
We do have a number of candidates. I wish there were more. I think the whole progressive movement has got to decide that, you know, if we really want changes, we got to replace the people in there instead of trying to influence the Democratic Party. You know, so the progressives run candidates in primaries. They usually lose, and then they got to support the people they were opposing. And that really makes the left disappear. You know, you get lost in the sauce. You vote for Biden, you're voting against Medicare for All, even though you're for it. You know, you're voting against the full-strength Green New Deal, even though you're for it. And as long as we do that, we disappear as an alternative. And we've got to, you know, run our own candidates with our own platform, and not get taken for granted, because that's what happens when we just surrender and settle for the lesser evil.
Now, I know Steve Greenfield, who I met at one of your events, is running for Congress in New York 19. Are there a lot of green congressional candidates across the country that could be viable?
There are candidates across the country. And, you know, some are more viable than others.
Mm-hmm.
Those are difficult races, given the amount of money you have to raise and the scale of the campaigns in a congressional district. We tend to win the majority of races we run in at the local level. And I think that's where we got to expand. And when you have a lot of local elected Greens in a congressional district, then the people say, well, you know, if we've got them in local office, why not Congress? It just changes the psychology. Because right now, like I said, a lot of people vote defensively for the Democrats, not because they like what the Democrats stand for, but because they're afraid of what the Republicans would do. And the Democrats are not putting forward real solutions. So we got to get in a position where people see us as a viable alternative. And I think that starts with electing more people to local office, which we've shown we can do.
You know, you're in contact with people all over the country, and you know as well as I do and a lot of people do that the plight of black people has been on the news a lot over the years. But one group of people who have been exploited and, you know, murdered actually, are the Native Americans. From your understanding, as you contact people throughout the country, how big of a problem is it for Native Americans?
Well, it's a huge problem. First of all, there are 370 treaties between indigenous nations and the United States government, which have been violated by the United States government, which in those treaties is supposed to provide social services, and they don't provide them in a lot of cases. And also, they've taken land that the treaties said belonged to the Indians. So we need a whole reparations program there. Honor the treaties and, you know, restore those lands to Native nations. And it's had a huge impact. You know, the violence, for example, against Native women, particularly around the Bakken oil field up there in North Dakota, where a lot of Native women have been killed and raped. That's an issue that hasn't got a lot of attention. There's actually more per capita, more police killings of American Indians than African Americans in this country. So that's a big issue. And then the coronavirus epidemic has really affected some Native nations in a particularly bad way, such as the Navajo Nation down in Arizona and New Mexico.
Wow. And why do you think that situation is not getting the press coverage it should be getting?
Well, Native people to the mass media are, you know, something, they don't exist. You know, they're like their history. A lot of them live in rural areas where the major media aren't centered and focused. And then urban Indians kind of get lost in the, you know, all the different groups that are in our cosmopolitan and urban areas. So, yeah, they've missed a lot of stories there. And I think that's why they're not getting the attention they should.
Do you think that there's kind of a schism between, like, the blacks and the Indians or Native Americans, where each one is opposing each other?
I don't see that. We had a demonstration, the largest demonstration in decades in Syracuse. The only thing that came close to it was a anti-Iraq war demonstration here in Syracuse in 2006. But that was people coming from all across of state. We had 2,000 or 3,000 people out yesterday, and there were American Indians there. You know, Onondaga Nation is close by. There are a lot of Mohawks and Oneidas in the city. And they were out there in solidarity. And then after the rally and people started marching, they marched to the Columbus Statute. And also this was spoken at from the rally platform that, you know, indigenous people have been abused too. So there was a lot of solidarity between American Indians and African Americans, and all the youth that showed up. I mean, it was mostly young people, overwhelmingly young, and they reflected the demographics of Syracuse, which is over half people of color. African Americans are the largest group. There are a lot of Puerto Ricans and other Latinos. They're American Indians, they're Asians, and they're whites. And they were all out there in proportionate numbers expressing solidarity. So I don't see, you know, blacks and Native Americans at odds. I see them expressing solidarity with each other.
That's really good to know. Let's get back to Steve Greenfield for a moment. You know, I talked to him quite a lot. And let's say he won. Let's say he won New York 19, and maybe only a handful of other Greens won for Congress. There would be a very small minority in Congress of Green Party members. Can that make a big difference in national legislation?
Oh, I think so, because then the progressive Democrats would have more leverage in their party, because they could tell the establishment, you better concede on some of these demands or there are going to be more Greens elected and less of us. So they would have a platform to articulate their program, and they would show both the voters that they had an alternative and the Democrats, they better not take us for granted or we're going to replace them. So they would have a lot of leverage in the political dynamic, I think.
And even on the state level.
Well, yeah, if they're in Congress, they would have influence on the state level, because the same thing could happen in the state legislature. And if we elected Greens to the state legislature, you'd have the same dynamic at the state level.
You know, you've been working within the Green Party for many, many years, and you know, you've been talking about ideas and programs and issues. Do you ever get so weary of this? You just feel like throwing your hands up and say, I can't do this anymore?
No. I mean, I may get weary and tired and I get a good night's sleep, you know, and then I'm ready to go again. Because I've been through so many movements where we started out as a small minority. Anti-Vietnam War movement, you know, 1966, 67, 65, 66, 67, and 68, public sentiment flipped against the war. The anti-nuclear movement, the anti-apartheid movement, getting a ban on fracking in New York. And now, you know, I ran for mayor here in Syracuse in 2017, and I was saying, and we had just the year before had so many murders that we had the third highest per capita murder rate in the country of all the cities in the country. And, you know, there was a clamor for more police as if they could stop the murders. And I was saying, no, we don't need more police. We need more investment in redressing the social conditions that produce crime and violence in the streets, and stop asking the police to be solving all the social problems they're not equipped to solve, and just limit what they do to, you know, solving crimes and catching criminals after the crimes have been committed. They can't prevent crime for the most part. And it was a tough sell, because, you know, people's first thought was to, we need more police. That's not what people are thinking now. They're talking about, they call it defunding the police. In other words, scaling back the police department's budgets and the size of the force, and getting more social workers and more investment in affordable housing and providing good health care and youth jobs and those kinds of programs that are proven to reduce crime. And, you know, I had a hard sell for, what is it, 3 years ago, but now that's what's on people's minds, and we're beginning to see movement in a lot of cities. You know, Los Angeles just did a big cut in their police budget, and people are beginning to realize that, you know, the police cannot do everything. We got to, you know, we send them into the schools, you know, when what you really need are more counselors to deal with problems kids are having. And so, you know, those ideas are, so that's just an example of how, you know, you keep plugging away and then you break through. And so I feel the same way about, you know, building the Green Party into a major third party in this country. At some point, we're going to break through because it's needed.
In 2000, everybody knew Ralph Nader ran as a Green, and people are still blaming Ralph Nader for Bush's win of the White House. Since Ralph Nader ran as a Green in 2000, Has the Green Party grown substantially?
Well, we've had our ups and downs, and you know, I take issue with the premise of your question. You know, Ralph Nader's vilified by the talking heads, the apologists for the Democratic Party, and they have access
right.
to the media. But you go out in the streets. You know, I remember in 2004 petitioning for him to get on a ballot in New York. And if I went up by Syracuse University, yeah, I got a lot of pushback from, you know, the professionals, you know, the professors and the credentialed people, the upper middle class. But if I went out in the neighborhoods and talked to working class people of all backgrounds, you know, they'd say, yeah, Ralph Nader, he's for the people. I'll sign that petition. So I think, you know, there's more talk about the backlash in the media than actually exists among the people. You know, I think he's still appreciated as somebody that fights for the people. And so, you know, the Greens have had their ups and downs. A lot of people thought when Obama was elected, things would change. So, you know, it was a hard time for us, but then things didn't change. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we came back. And so in 2012, Jill Stein, well, in 2016, she got more than double the vote she got in 2012 because people saw what had happened under Obama. So, you know, it's been up and down, but we have persisted and we're still here. And like I said at the beginning, I think, given the utter failure of both governing parties to deal with some, you know, problems that are, we know what to do, like test, trace, and isolate to suppress the infections of the coronavirus. And it's not being done. So that gives us an opportunity to step into that political vacuum.
So we just have a couple minutes left, Howie. If somebody wants to become part of your campaign, or send you a donation, how could they do so?
They should go to my website. It's HowieHawkins.us. HowieHawkins.us. And there they can find out, you know, our lot of material on our positions on the issues and what we think about what's going on. You can volunteer. You can sign up and get our bulletins about what the campaign's doing. And you can push the donate button and send us a little money. We're the only campaign in the country that's going to qualify for federal primary matching funds. The major party candidates don't want to do it because if you accept those funds, you can't spend more than $50 million on your primary. And for the corporate parties, that's not enough. And none of the other third-party candidates seem to have a strong enough campaign to qualify. We have to raise $5,000 in 20 states in contributions of $250 or less. And we're just on the verge of qualifying. So everybody that contributes, once we qualify, up to the first $250 they contribute, it will be matched by Uncle Sam. And that will enable us to put money into getting on all the ballots and running a serious, credible campaign.
Terrific. I hope to have you back on All Access Closed as this campaign season evolves. So you have been listening to Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks, Howie. Have a great day. And I hope you keep on enjoying your campaign. It's pretty daunting, I think. So have a great day.
You too. Thanks for having me.